It's the Criterion. It's the Criterion. 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 N.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special episode, season finale extravaganza of the Criterion Project, the show where usually we talk about movies in the Criterion Channel and or Criterion Collection, but today we're doing something a little different. With me is, as always, the great Rachel Wagner. Rachel, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm so excited about this. And let us know if you're listening, let us know what you think, because we could do more bonuses.
Yeah, that's right. We are always down to do some fun stuff. So why don't you tell the listeners what we're doing today, Rachel?
Yeah, so in celebration of Conrado's birthday coming up in May, we are doing the movies from 1992. We're doing our favorite, top five favorite movies made in 1992. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, so as you can probably tell, I was born in 92, which means that I'm about to turn 30 years old. So it's kind of a milestone that I am approaching with excitement and dread at the same time. So I thought it was a great moment to do something like this, which we haven't done in a while. I used to go on Rachel's podcast, Rachel's Reviews, to talk about top 10s from previous years every now and then. And we haven't done that in a while. Usually when we do those top 10s, they went on for a long time. So today we're doing only top 5s, but we will be rattling off some other titles at the end of the episode. But because of that, we've also made an effort to have no overlap in our list so we can talk about the most amount of movies as possible.
And I would say 1992, pretty good year.
Yeah, lots to pick from. Lots of stuff that could have made my list any other day. And some of that stuff I think is going to be on your list. So why don't we just get into it? Do you want to start with your number five?
All right. My number five is a crowd pleaser, if there ever was one. It is A League of Their Own. And Penny Marshall, she knew how to make a pretty, I think, crowd pleasing film. Of course, about the women's female baseball league during World War II. So it has a great cast with, of course, Tom Hanks in a very memorable role as a grumpy coach. Gina Davis, Madonna's in here, Rosie O'Donnell. They're all great. It's just a really wonderful little story about strong women. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I love this movie as well. I think it's one of those great 90s, like you were saying, crowd-pleasing classics. And also one of those very memorable classic 90s weepies, you know, that makes you well up with emotion and cry at the end. But what I love about this one in particular is that it's so much fun on the road to that emotional cathartic climax. And it's a very, very fun movie and a very effective movie for, you know, kind of like Hollywood doing its thing and doing it really well.
Yeah. I think I can't imagine anybody really disliking this movie. You know what I mean? Like, it's just so pleasant, and we can always use more movies about strong women, and I think you know you get that here, so I'm sure there are those out there, but I don't know, it's so sweet.
yeah definitely. And I think so much of it, I think you're right, is about the performances. I think everyone is very charming. I mean, Tom Hanks is very funny. I think it's one of his best performances, actually, or one of my favorites at the very least. And then Rosie O'Donnell and Madonna are also really fun in supporting parts. And the main relationship between Gina Davis and Lori Petty, the characters who they're the sisters, is very, very touching and very emotional, right?
Yeah, and Gina Davis, she was great in this role. Which seems like she's basically retired from acting, but I really enjoyed her in even in bad movies, she was usually good.
Yeah, she's a great actor. And we talked about her in a previous episode on Thelma and Louise, which she's great in as well. So people can check that out if they want.
Okay. What is your number five?
Yeah, my number five is a movie that I think we both have seen and we both really like, and it's called Porco Rosso from the animated movie from Studio Ghibli, directed by Hayao Miyazaki, about a kind of aviator who has been cursed and turned into a pig man or a man pig, something like that. So he is kind of this aviator who, you know, there's like a World War One / Italy kind of thing going on, and but it's kind of like a fantasy world, and he just like goes around fighting bad guys and, you know, being cursed and living a life that it's kind of like, you know, a little bit melancholy and a little bit fun. How would you describe Porco Rosso? I guess it's a hard movie to describe now that I think about it.
Well, I think it has a lot of Miyazaki themes that he mm-hmm. likes to put into his movies. It's he loves aviation. He mm-hmm. he loves Italy. You see that in a bunch of his movies, and it's very sarcastic. I mean, in the dub, Michael Keaton I think is the perfect choice mm-hmm. for Porco Rosso. He's very sarcastic. He's very funny, and I kind of like the fact that they don't really explain why a pig or, you know, there's a curse, yeah. but it's barely talked about. It's just like, this is the character, deal with it.
Mm-hmm. I think you get at a couple of the things that I love about the movie. First of all, the character of Porco Rosso, who I find very endearing and I connect with him a lot. You know, he's just this Italian pig who's like flying around, drinking booze and just like generally hanging out with kind of like this sad layer underneath, right? Very melancholic character, even though he is sarcastic and he is kind of cool, which always speaks to me. And I agree with you that the performance in the dub is actually really good. One of the best dubs that they've done for a Ghibli movie, I think.
Disney did such a great job with those dubs of that era where they were doing the dubs compared to the G Kids dubs. They're just not as good. They did just an absolutely great job.
Yeah. Well, this dub is definitely pretty great.
Oh, and, yeah.
And the other thing I love about the movie is that kind of Miyazaki feel of that it's a movie kind of just about hanging out and the vibe and just the beauty of the animation, the beautiful Italian beaches and the plot is kind of, it keeps going. There is a plot, but it's not the main focus. You feel like it's more about being in this world that he really loves. And those are, I think, the kinds of Miyazaki movies that I love the most. Like My Neighbor Totoro and Kiki's Delivery Service and this, they all feel to me like are very much about the vibe. And even though I love something like Spirited Away or Princess Mononoke, I think the ones that really hit me are the ones that are more kind of that more low-key vibe.
Yeah, it's so hard to pick between such a great
such a great career, yeah.
I certainly am glad that we get kind of both sides. He is such a gift for creating characters that you feel empathy for, that you enjoy, that are complex, that are interesting, even in something like Spirited Away, where Chihiro could get kind of lost in everything mm-hmm. Going around her. I still feel connected to the character, and I just think that he is just not only a master animator, but a master storyteller.
Yep, I think that's very much agree with that. He's an excellent, he's an excellent storyteller, excellent animator. I don't think there's anyone like him who can turn the most, kind of like mundane, small scale event into a set piece in his movies. Yeah. You know, like now we're talking more about Spirited Away than Porco Rosso, but but the moment in Spirited Away when she has to go down the stairs, I think it's incredible, it's such a small moment, but it's like the thing that I remember the most because it's so visceral for me, mm-hmm. who was a scared mm-hmm. fight. So.
Yeah, and in this one, it's really more just about this kind of sassy, fun character to get to spend time with. I can't think of like one moment that I'm like, that's the moment. But but I have it at number 8 on my list, so I really enjoy it. It's really fun.
Yeah, definitely. We're both fans of it. I even went as Porco Rosso one Halloween a couple years ago. So.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, that's how much I love it. Anyway, let's move on to your number four. What do you have there?
Okay, my number four is Malcolm X, directed by Spike Lee, Denzel Washington, Angela Bassett. And the autobiography of Malcolm X is one of my favorite books I've ever read. And it was hugely influential on me. I read it in college, and it was just, I've never had such an experience where reading a book completely changed my opinion on a character and a person. Not that I had like some strong opinion about Malcolm X, but I had just always heard about him being like this radical and this, and reading the book, it really blew me away about how one person can live so many lives in one life. And have the capacity to change, especially as a public character, to change so dramatically and to be that honest and vulnerable. And I think that Spike Lee captures that really well in this movie. I think you really see all the different sides of Malcolm X, which is hard to do because he had so many different sides. He changed so much from starting as a young man, you know, and then he ends up in prison. And then he finds Elijah Muhammad, and then he falls away from that, and he has his journey to Mecca, and all of that is all so real. And I just think he's an amazing person, and his to be willing to change and grow so much in one life is, I think, very impressive, especially as a public figure. And I just think this movie's great. And I think he's an amazing human.
Yeah. And also, a relatively short life that was cut off in its prime. So, you know, it makes it even more impressive how much he accomplished while he was still here. And I agree with you that this is a great, great movie. I haven't seen it in a while. And I was hoping to have enough time to rewatch it before this we record this podcast. But it is a pretty long movie and I couldn't fit it in. But I think, especially after hearing you talk about it now in such a beautiful way, I really want to rewatch it and revisit it because it's been a couple of years, since I last saw it. But I do remember a lot of it because it is very, powerful, like you were saying. And it's great to see Spike Lee working in such a wide canvas. You know, it's not, he doesn't always get huge budgets and all the resources. You know, he's done a lot of independent movies throughout his life and he does great with the resources that he has most of the time, but to see him on this, you know, sprawling epic is really special. And of course the Denzel Washington performance is fantastic.
Yeah. And I feel like some of Spike's later films, even ones I've enjoyed, I feel like he doesn't trust his audience enough. He has to spell out, this is what you need to learn. This is what you need to take away from this picture. Whereas I feel like some of his earlier films, he was a little more confident in, and maybe that's partly because we become where we are at. And so he's not as confident in people. I don't know.
But which would be fair. Yeah.
But I think that is, this feels like a really confident film to me.
Yeah, definitely. Very confident film. And, you know, for a director who was at the time kind of a little bit controversial and even maligned for that confidence, you know, this young, very opinionated Black filmmaker who came out of nowhere and then he was having Do the Right Thing, which was such a political movie, and now he wants to do Malcolm X and what's he going to do? You know, it was a big thing. And I think he does a really beautiful job. I remember thinking when I first saw this movie that this was maybe a little too conventional. I was feeling, oh, it's just like any other biopic. But really, when I saw it again and over the years, it really has also dawned on me how important and how effective it is for it to be one of those classic, big biopic type of movies. Yeah. And that the movie does bring or does, like, you know, build up its power from that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know you're not a big reader, but I'm telling you, that book, Autobiography, is, I highly recommend it. It is so good.
All right. I will take that to heart. I have been wanting to read more. So I think this is going to go on the to read list.
Yeah. All right. So what's your number four?
So my number four is only what might very well be the best action movie of all time. I know a lot of people feel that way. I don't think you've seen this one, Rachel. It's the movie Hard Boiled, which is a Hong Kong action movie directed by John Woo, starring Chow Yun-fat and a favorite of yours, Tony Leung. So there is that. It is a pretty violent movie, though, so I feel like maybe that's and I feel like you know, like shoot 'em up Hong Kong movies are generally not your you know, your bread and butter. So I don't know how much you would enjoy this movie, but I do have to say, if you want to see some impressive action sequences, this is where you gotta go. You know, Hong Kong movies are known for their action in the 80s and the 90s, and John Woo in particular, the director, is known for a style of martial arts, or, you know, action movies, action really, called Gung Fu, in which he like brought a lot of like gun play into it. And I think we've talked about how I am not the biggest fan of gunfights in movies, that I don't always find them very exciting, because, you know, you see some one person shoot, then you cut to the other person being hit or not being hit, shooting back. And it's just a lot of cutting back and forth between people standing, holding guns and shooting, right? Which to me doesn't feel as kinetic, as exciting as, for example, a martial arts fight or a car chase. And the great thing about John Woo is that he brings that sort of like level of movement and excitement and action into the gunfights that he does. And that it makes them incredibly big and exciting. And, you know, a lot of people that I don't know if you're a fan, like, you know, you can see some of like, that excessive Michael Bay or Tony Scott style in him, but I think he does it with such precision and such, I don't know, there's just something about the way he does it that works for me so, so well. And I think this is his masterpiece, his most impressive movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard about that from our friend Jen Johans. She loves that movie.
Oh, good.
She loves a Hong Kong action movies.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, but I haven't seen it, but I have heard of it. Maybe I'll have to make out a blind spot pick.
I think that'd be interesting. And I think this would definitely be the one to pick. There is particularly the climax of the movie, which takes place at a hospital, is really, really incredible. It involves, like, you know, shooting up the bad guys while trying to save a bunch of babies, take them out of the hospital. So it's really, you know, the poster on Letterboxd is Chow Yun-fat holding a gun in one hand and the baby in the other, you know. So it's kind of like this very spectacular climactic action sequence. And
the gunfights can get a little like hiding behind columns, you know, that you see.
So
I can see what you're saying.
Yeah, totally. It's all here, it's all about like people like jumping and shooting at the same time and rolling on the floor and, you know, like all kinds of crazy stuff that goes on. Yeah, and I was just going to say, in terms of plot, not very important. It's kind of like an undercover cop and hard-boiled cop kind of have to like team up in order to defeat the bad guys, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And really the main event is the action and also some of the personality of two great, great performers like Chow Yun-fat and Tony Leung, who both are really, you know, on it in this movie and have great chemistry together.
Yeah, very good. Well, as my friend Ryan likes to say, we're taking a hard left.
Ryan, what do you got for us?
For my third pick is Howard's End. And speaking of another book that I love, it's Howard's End. I love the Ian Forster novel. I love all of the characters. And they capture it so well. I mean, Merchant Ivory films were so special. Have they been topped? I don't know. Maybe Downton Abbey, maybe more series now. But I just love their movies. They were so beautiful and such great casts. And with Howard's End, I think what's so impressive about this movie is it's fairly easy to make a movie about, you know, 2-3 characters. But when you have a movie that has like 9-10 rich characters that get a full arc, I think that's when you have something very special. And Howard's End is such a movie. You have characters that are only in the movie for a few scenes, and yet we get to know them in a really intimate way. You know, people like the Bass or when you have and you have someone like Henry Wilcox, who could have been just a rich jerk, but there's more to him. He does love his family. He loves his wife. And when he breaks down at the end of the movie, I feel for him, even though he's not really a very good person. And that to me makes an interesting portrayal and an interesting film. And, you know, someone like Helen in the movie, that she's such a like true free spirit, but is she, the movie kind of at first sort of judges her, but then doesn't judge her. But that's kind of going with Margaret's character, where she also has that journey with her sister. And by the end, you know, she stands up for her sister. I mean, I just love all of these characters. I think they are really, really deep and complex and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I think the story is really great, and it's beautifully made, incredibly acted. I don't know. I think it's great.
Yeah, this is another movie that I like very much, but also haven't seen in a while. But I do also remember a lot about it, especially the kind of very luscious and, you know, beautiful filmmaking that is kind of characteristic of the Merchant Ivory movies. And you know, one of our first episodes, if you remember, was about A Room with a View, which is another one of their movies, which is also a beautiful looking movie. But definitely more of a romantic comedy compared to Howard's End. Yeah, which is a little bit more, like you're saying, more complex and brings in some darker themes and emotions. And a very rich movie, like you're saying. I think you're absolutely right. The acting is excellent, and so is the script and the complications of the characters. I think it's one of those things where there's a particular kind of costume drama, literary adaptation, that really thrives on having complicated characters that you want to, that it's not necessarily that you love them, like you were saying, but it's more so that you want to understand them and you want to spend time with them because you want to know what they're going to do and what they're thinking. You know, it makes me think also of a movie we covered recently, Age of Innocence, which I felt also has that in its cast and its kind of ensemble.
In Howard's End, they talk about class in a nuanced, interesting way, because in a lot of ways, Helen thinks she's kind of rescuing the Bass, but is she really, you know, does she understand them as well as she thinks she does? There's layers there. It's not just rich people bad, poor people are saints. You know, it's not one of those kinds of stories. Mm-hmm.
You can tell it's coming from someone who has thought a lot about it, you know, especially in the novel from Ian Forster, and who has complicated feelings about all these subjects. And I think it really comes through. I think that the adaptation really does it justice, even though I haven't read the book, but I feel like it feels to me very authentic, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I need to be making my book recommendations for you in this podcast.
Yeah.
And I should say that Howard's End is a Criterion release. So maybe one of these days it'll be on the channel and we can talk about it.
Yeah, certainly it's been a while since we've talked about Merchant Ivory, so it could be a well that we return sometime soon. And speaking of that, I think that segues really well into my number three, actually, which is a movie by a director who I was surprised we haven't talked about on Criterion Project yet, and maybe I will want to correct that in the near future, which is the Iranian director Abbas Kiarostami, who is, you know, you can't get more Criterion-y than him. He's like this Iranian director who came up in the late 80s and early 90s and kind of really became a figure of the art house movement that put Iranian cinema kind of in the international map, with making a lot of movies that brought a lot of meta elements to them. And, you know, in this one, which is actually it's known by two different names. On Letterboxd, it's called Life and Nothing More. On Criterion Channel, currently it's available under the name And Life Goes On. And I think And Life Goes On is the more literal translation of the Iranian title, if I'm correct. But it is known as both titles. And it is basically a movie in which a director of a movie and his kid go on a drive from Tehran, which is the capital of Iran, to this village, trying to find, because there's been an earthquake, and in the aftermath of the earthquake, they're going to the village because they filmed a movie in the village, and the director is wondering if the kid, who was the star of his previous movie, how is he doing? Did he survive the earthquake? How is his family doing? Because they live in this village, which is where he shot the movie. The interesting part is that the name of the movie is Where Is My Friend's House, which is the name of a Abbas Kiarostami movie that he directed in the late 80s. And there was an earthquake in Iran in 1990. And presumably he drove to this village to see what was happening with the kid. And the name of the kid in the movie is the name of the kid. The director is not played by Abbas Kiarostami, is played by a different actor. But throughout the movie, we do see a lot of the actors from the movie Where Is My Friend's House playing themselves and interacting with the director. And it is kind of this road trip, I guess you would call it kind of like a slice of life type of movie that has these meta elements, but it really is about going, driving around, portraying what it looks like after this earthquake has hit the countryside, and basically spending time with some of the people who have survived the earthquake and seeing what they're doing in order to, you know, like the title of the movie says, life goes on and what happens after that kind of stuff. And I found it an incredibly beautiful, very, very touching movie of the kind that I really absolutely love and touches me very much in how simple it is in its setup and how much it can say with so with its minimalism. Have you seen this movie, Rachel?
I haven't even heard of it, so this is new great. To me. Yeah,
yeah, and I don't know how familiar you are with Kiarostami and his movies. I might have mentioned a couple on the podcast before, but I think he really is a director that we should cover at some point because he's really special, and he is one of my favorite directors, certainly. And he manages with almost like Ozu, who is another director that I think about a lot when I watch his movies. He touches me every time, and I get overwhelmed emotionally with his movies, even when it doesn't feel like they're going to. By the end, I'm always like so emotional and crying, and it's just beautiful for me to experience that. So I definitely recommend this movie, even if you haven't seen the other ones. It's worth it.
Yeah, that sounds really good. So my number two is a very, very popular film. and I do really enjoy it. Obviously, it's number two. It's Aladdin. It was kind of the peak Disney Renaissance era with, just after Beauty and the Beast. Mm-hmm. And this is the last of the Ashman involvement in any of these films. It was taken over by Tim Rice. But I don't know. I mean, Aladdin's great. I mean, it's one of Robin Williams as a genie is the most iconic voice acting performance ever, mm-hmm. in my opinion. I think you could have made an argument for him being nominated for supporting actor, even mm-hmm. as a voice performance.
And it's, I think at the time, some people good. Did. I think it was a big talking point at the time that this Robin Williams, we should give him something somehow. And he did win a special Golden Globe for it, I think.
Oh, he did? That's cool. I didn't know that. Yeah, I definitely could have seen that happening, and it would have been deserved. I mean, evidently in the recording they would just kind of just let him go, and he would just and he's so great, and I love the songs are just really good bops. They're really fun. Jasmine and Aladdin are a lot of fun. They have nice chemistry together. Jafar is a pretty fun villain. I would have loved to have gotten a Jafar song. They ended up with just the Aladdin reprise, and so that was a little bit of a shame. But he's great. I think he's great. Iago's hilarious. R.E.P. Gilbert Gottfried, so it's a great villain sidekick. Even mm-hmm. like Pooh, I think that's really cute. Yeah. And has a nice message too, of the diamond in the rough and not trying to be someone that you're not. And when he does give the genie his freedom at the end, it's very sweet and emotional, mm-hmm. especially, you know, with what happened with Robin Williams. That scene always makes me cry now. And I don't know, I just love Aladdin. I mean, I feel like, again, who doesn't like Aladdin? It's really great.
Yeah, I mean, you are the queen of Disney movies, you know, queen of rom-com, but also to me, the queen of Disney movies. So I think it only makes sense that Aladdin is on your list. And I agree that it's a very fun movie.
Yeah.
It's interesting because to me, it always feels like a little bit of a kind of like a turning point or like a pivotal moment for animation and for the Disney Renaissance as well. I think that, you know, Robin Williams as the genie, such a, you know, great and big performance in many ways, you know, also culturally, that that kind of like kicks off this kind of like celebrities doing voices in movies thing. And it brings us to this.
And that would be added to even more with The Lion King and with Toy Story. Both of those had
It just keeps going from there, you know. Like because you look at the movies right before, like Beauty and the Beast, the biggest celebrity is like Angela Lansbury. I don't think it's really quite the same, right? And then it keeps going and going, and obviously there's like Shrek and Madagascar, and then you get into like where we are now. But very influential in that way. Also influential in the way that it pivots into comedy in a way that it would also see in general mainstream American animation, I think. Also in its use of computer graphics, it's also very influential. Although that had already been going on with the previous movies at Disney. But it always felt to me like more of like an interesting pivotal moment for Disney and a movie that I'd enjoy, but maybe it's because I really do love Beauty and the Beast and I love Lion King was like my kid favorite as a kid, and this one is kind of sandwiched in between that it always I never feel like maybe I gave it as much of a of attention as some other people did, but I do really enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not in my top 10 favorite Disney films in my canon ranking. I had it at 16 this last time. So some people might think that's kind of low, but I always say I have like a 25 car pile up
for number
for
one,
that top 10. Cause there's, I love different things for different films for different reasons. And so it's tough, but yeah, I think, it's a really charming, fun film. Great vocal performances throughout. Like I said, I think Iago's really funny and a great supporting villain.
Yeah, and definitely if you're looking for, you know, beautiful, fluid, impressive animation, you can't do much better than Aladdin. Like some of that animation on the genie. And on Jafar and some of the other characters, the special effects or the way the characters are animated is so impressive. And that's what if you want to feel nostalgic, like really look at something like this and see what hand-drawn animation can do and how it like moves so beautifully that it just feels nostalgic for a different time, you know?
Well, what do you have it to?
Yeah, my number two is the movie Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. Which is obviously directed by David Lynch, and it's a sort of prequel to Twin Peaks, the series. And it's a movie that I had never seen because Twin Peaks is one of those things that is kind of a blind spot for me, even though I do love a lot of David Lynch movies because, you know, I'm so bad at watching TV series and it takes so long to get through them that I had never made the time to watch it. But I had watched the first season of Twin Peaks before, and I have made, especially after watching this movie, I'm making a concerted effort to catch up with Twin Peaks this summer. I've decided that it's summer of Twin Peaks for me, and I'm going to finally catch up with it. But this movie, I was completely blown away by it because I had heard a lot of mixed stuff about it. And at the time that it was released, it got a pretty negative reception mostly, I think. But I thought it was absolutely, I gotta be honest, I'm not surprised why you got a negative reception. It is a lot. It is a very dark and very intense movie in a lot of ways, in a way that not even Twin Peaks the show really is. It's kind of more about this quirky town and there's some dark elements to it, but there's also a lot of levity. Whereas this movie, you know, after the first half hour, it really becomes this very harrowing portrait of a teenage girl's mind while she's going through a very hard time and it's being, you know, kind of abused by the person who ends up killing her, which I'm not going to say who it is just because it might be a spoiler for the show, who starts mm-hmm. with this whole who killed Laura Palmer question. And the main character of this movie is Laura Palmer, who is, you know, kind of absent from the show. And then here she gets to have the spotlight. And I think it's a very raw, very honest, very intense, but also very loving and understanding portrayal of her state of mind, which, you know, doesn't want to make it like too soft or sugar-coated or make it like, you know, make it better for her. I think it's loving in the way that it really feels like trying to understand what she would be going through, trying to really say like, this is where she would be at. And I think the actor, Cheryl Lee, who plays Laura Palmer in this movie, gives such an incredible performance. One of the most, one of the best performances I've ever seen. It's just so, so intense and so affecting. And I think it took a lot of guts for her to give that performance. And I'm glad she did, because I really, really loved the movie, which is weird to say for a movie that is so hard to watch in some ways and so intense and dark. But I really appreciated it. I assume mm-hmm. you haven't seen this one, have
no,
you?
No, I mean, I've heard of Twin Peaks. I've never seen any of it. I know they did a revival, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. Last year? Yeah, a couple of years ago, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen any Twin Peaks. I think I've only seen David Lynch. I think I've only seen the... didn't he do the...
Well, we covered him with Eraserhead in this podcast. Yes, that's for sure.
Eraserhead. And didn't he do the Simple Story?
The Straight one? Story, yeah, story, which I love. And it's very really unlike good. Most of his movies, but it's really beautiful, yeah.
It's the only ones I've seen. but yeah, that's, that sounds really interesting. Who did you say that the actress was?
Her name is Cheryl Lee, and she didn't really do too much, even though she's still acting. And she is in the Twin Peaks revival, and she's been in a... She's in Winter's Bone. She has a supporting role in that and some other movies. But watching this movie, I really felt like, oh man, like this is such a talented person. Like she should have been like one of the great movie stars of our time. And it's such a shame that the movie didn't really catch on. I think there was a little bit of snobbery of it being based on a TV show. And it is a weird movie standing on its own. It's very connected to the show. But I think it's so... You know, it hits you so hard that I was just so impressed.
I was just seeing online that evidently she teaches at UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television.
All right.
Yeah. So
good for her.
Way to go. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Very cool. I'll maybe one day I'll check out more David Lynch.
I think, yeah.
Well, I mean, I've seen his Dune too.
So oh, three. Okay. Yeah. Check, what check. About Elephant Man? Have you seen that?
Yes, I've seen that. So maybe I'm not so bad.
You've seen more than you thought. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, my number one it's probably no surprise, because over on my channel right now, I'm doing Muppet May. I love the Muppets. As my fifth year doing Muppet May. And one of my favorites is The Muppet Christmas Carol. And I love Christmas Carol. I did a whole series of Christmas Carol on my blog back in 2014, where I reviewed 35 different versions.
Wow. The early days, too, of your blog, I think, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I always love projects like that, because to me, it's really interesting. It's kind of like if you gave everybody a prompt, and here's the basic writing prompt, and then see what everybody comes up with that's different. And that's kind of how I feel like when you watch like all different versions of Christmas Carol. It's interesting to me to see what all these, whether it's Muppets or Mickey or there's a great version with Patrick Stewart that I love. I even defend the motion capture one from 2009.
Oh, the Jim Carrey one.
That
yeah.
Everyone hates, but I like it. the great Alistair Sims version from 1951. That's one of my favorites. But I would say that the Muppet Christmas Carol is probably my favorite non-traditional version. I mean, it's hard because they're so like Scrooge with Bill Murray. Hilarious. Love that. I just love the whole story of Christmas Carol. I love the idea that nobody's a lost cause and that there's hope for anybody, even somebody as despicable as Scrooge and mean as Scrooge. And so going back and seeing his redemption through the course of the story, I just think it's beautiful. Again, another book that I love. I love Christmas Carol. And I think that this actually is a very faithful translation of Christmas Carol story. Mm-hmm. Because they have Gonzo as Dickens, they have a lot of the text from the novel in the movie. And so you get better, a more accurate portrayal of the story than you would expect from it being Muppets. But but yeah, I mean, I love the fact they have Kermit and Piggy married, and the girl children are pigs and the boys are frogs. That's hilarious. I love the music. I've heard some people say, oh, the music's not like, I love it. I just think it's so fun and cheerful and enjoyable. I mean, the love song isn't that good, but they took it out. So they acknowledged that it's not that great, but yeah, I love, watching it on Christmas Eve, because they have the whole song One More Sleep Till Christmas. Mm-hmm. So it's perfect to watch on Christmas Eve. And obviously I love Christmas movies and I love the Muppets, and Michael Caine, he's so great. He plays this completely straight. He is not winking at the camera at all. He's playing these characters, these Muppets, as if they were any other characters that he's acting with. And I think that really works great.
Yeah. I mean, I think I couldn't say anything that you better than you've said already. I also do love this movie. I think it's a great, great adaptation of the rare book that I have actually read, because it's so short. But it's great. I mean, I also love the Muppets. I think this is a great movie. And of course, it makes total sense for it to be number one on your list, because we have, you know, the Rachel trifecta for me, obviously, rom-coms, animation, and Christmas, you know? So here we have
period film, number three, animated musical, two, rom-com. And then I have number one, Muppet Christmas musical.
Of course. Absolutely. And I agree with you that Michael Caine is great. The songs are really touching. I do love that opening song about Scrooge. I always think it's so funny and it's so cool. I also think it's so great. When I watched this last Christmas season, after not having seen it in a while, it was just a really great to see, you know, the Muppets in such wonderful, beautiful sets. And it was such a set movie that had like that kind of like big Hollywood studio kind of like, we're building a whole street where we can like have all these Muppets populated and feel like an actual street, but full of like this furry animals kind of a thing, that felt so special. I remember at the time when I saw it as a kid, because the great thing about those Muppet movies for me as a kid was to see the Muppets in an environment that felt so realistic, right? I think that's what was very special to me about them, and what you didn't really get in the Muppet Show that often. So that was really great to revisit. And the other thing that touched me a lot as a kid that I still love as an adult, and that was super influential for me, was the idea of making Gonzo the Charles Dickens of the story, and to have him and Rizzo tell the story to the audience, breaking the fourth wall and have that meta textual element to the movie. When I was a kid and I saw that, it really, really influenced me and opened up my mind to like what storytelling in movies could be in a way that I hadn't really considered before. And obviously there's other movies that do similar things, and the Looney Tunes break the fourth wall all the time, and the Muppets break the fourth wall in a lot of movies. But just the idea of making the writer of the original story a character in the movie was really revolutionary to me as a kid. And I always will think of this movie fondly because of that. And I also think they do such a great job with it, because it's so funny, and it's such a funny idea to have that in a Christmas Carol adaptation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love that they did that. And again, it introduces the kids to watching to the actual text that they have quite a bit of, which I think is cool. And also Statler and Waldorf being Marley and Marley.
Yeah, so fantastic. Funny.
Marley and Marley was really great. I also think it's sweet that this is directed by Brian Henson, the son of Jim Henson. And Jim Henson died in 1990. So this was only I think this was the first project for the Muppets after. And so that's very nice.
And it feels very loving and very in the tradition, you know. I mean, obviously it was hard for them to adapt after Jim Henson passed away, and you go into an adaptation of something that's familiar was kind of a big risk, but also I think a way to feel sturdy after the creative head had gone away. But I think it pays off in a really loving way, and I think it does really showcase the beauty of the Muppets. And
I wish they would do more literary adaptations, because I really enjoyed Muppet Treasure Island too. I think it's really good. So I would say do more.
Yeah, well, I would say is have the Muppets be in the real world. How about that? In order to, I'm going to get in my old person kind of like soapbox, but I really, really don't like the way that they use so much green screen in this newer Muppet project. And I think it feels fake and it feels weird, and it doesn't feel, the great thing about the Muppets, I always thought as a kid, was that they felt like they were real and they were in our world and they interacted with celebrities and they interacted with people. And you could, you know, and in movies like this, you see them walking around the street. And that's what makes it so magical. And you kind of lose that. And they lose a little bit of their magic when that's the case.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of puppetry, really, to me.
Yeah. Well, and also their most recent feature was The Muppets Most Wanted. And it felt like the Muppets were an afterthought in that one. It was all Tina Fey and, you know, and these Ricky Gervais and people like that. Like, the stars should just be a cameo, should be an afterthought.
Right. Well, that's interesting talking about Muppet Christmas Carol, you know, when Michael Caine gives such a great lead performance, but he's surrounded by Muppets, which is great to have just one person, kind of like in the Muppet show, you know, you have one human and then surrounded by the Muppets. I think that also works.
And in Treasure Island, it's the same with Tim Curry as Long John Silver.
So you just need to strike the right balance. But it's been hard for them to do with the Muppets. Yeah,
it has. So what is your number one?
So my number one is a movie that I think we both really like. I personally love it. And it is The Player, directed by Robert Altman. A Hollywood satire about an executive played by Tim Robbins, who is being sent kind of death threats by a writer who he rejected his script in the past, and he must be looking for revenge. And it's kind of like this, you know, satire about the darker side of Hollywood in a very Robert Altman way. It's very meandering at some points and has a lot of celebrity cameos, and we're just going through a lot of like mixing of comedic set pieces in which like every talk from like the executives at Hollywood is like complete nonsense, and they're trying to make these complete nonsense movies, and they're talking about like getting Julia Roberts for the part or whatever, and it's very funny. And then you have all this darker side of like the mystery that is going on and what is happening with this sleazy executive and this writer who you know seems to be on his case. And I think you watched this pretty recently and you really liked it too, right, Rachel?
I did. I had it at 5 originally, but then I decided just to have more movies. I put it at 6.
Mm-hmm.
So I really enjoy this film. I think it's really funny. I think it's spot on with its commentary. I like all the performances. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I love it too. And I think one of the reasons why it's number one on my list and why it was really, even though I love all the movies that we've talked about today, it was always going to be The Player number one for me, because it kind of like, for personal and also like, you know, historical reasons, it's another movie that meant a lot to me at the time that I saw it, and that really, especially the ending, which reveals itself to be like kind of like also like has a meta element to it, and it's very kind of like mind-bending in a way that when I first saw it as a teenager, it really blew my mind. That it was like, oh my God, this is so crazy what they did with this movie, you know? But watching it as an adult, especially recently, because when I heard that you watched it and you liked it, I revisited the movie because I got curious to watch it again, just hearing you talk about it a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And the ending, I still love the ending, but like I feel like I appreciate it on a different level now as well, of like how good it is at having a clever ending, but also making the cleverness of the ending speak to what the movie is trying to talk about in terms of Hollywood and storytelling and the mix of art and commerce and the kind of like, and the fakeness of movies and the kind of stuff that we get from movies. And it really speaks to me. And I also feel like it is so good that every Hollywood satire afterwards feels to me like they're just trying to do like The Player thing, and they're not quite doing it. Even when it's good, like in a movie like Adaptation, which I think it's great, I still at the end feel like, yeah, this is kind of like, they didn't really quite stick the landing like The Player. It feels like, you know, So it's one of those movies that is so good that makes you, you know, it all the movies pale in comparison, even when they're great.
Yeah, and I just love everything that has to do with the movie, the Habeas Corpus.
Yeah, the movie that they're trying to make.
Yeah, they have a happy ending to the movie.
Mm-hmm. To the movie that's about like death row. Yeah, and it's so funny, like the recurring jokes of like them going into the pitch meeting, and it's always like, well, you know, it's a dark drama, but it has comedy, and of course it has heart. Is it gonna have romance? Of course it's gonna have romance, and it's gonna be thrilling, right? Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and isn't it Bruce everything. Willis who they're like, we want to put
Bruce Willis and Julia Roberts. Yeah,
yeah.
And then
Richard. And I do think that's something that has changed. Like now it would definitely be the IP mm-hmm. as opposed to the movie star. Cause I don't think there's very many movie stars that can open pictures like they used to.
And also and it's not right. It's not the main attraction anymore. The main attraction mm-hmm. is the, so if you were to remake it today, you know, if this was a regular episode of Criterion Project and we're pitching our remakes, yeah. it would be kind of like have to be about, a franchise, right? And they would have to be talking, is this based on anything? Or like maybe it'll be one of those Ready yeah. Player One or like, Space Jam thing where you mix everything together.
It'd be like Habeas Corpus Cloverfield or something like yeah. that.
Yeah. Can we tie this to something pre-existing? You know, so it's yeah. like Sonic the Hedgehog meets yeah. Habeas Corpus.
Yeah, it's a great movie. I really enjoyed it. So good choice for number one. So real quick, I just wanted to mention the other ones I had on my list. I have Death Becomes Her at 7. Great
movie.
Funny comedy. Porco Rosso at 8. I have yeah. Far and Away at 9, which I feel like is underrated. Ron Howard.
Controversial, yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. I mean, the whole scenes with the race to get the land are just incredible, beautiful. I like Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise. They have great chemistry, and I don't know. I think it's underrated. I like it.
I've never seen it, so mm-hmm. I'd be curious.
And then I have The Bodyguard at 10, which to me, Kevin Costner and Whitney Houston have some of the best chemistry I've ever seen. They were great. Mm-hmm. The story isn't that great, but it's serviceable and the songs are so incredible. And they had just great chemistry, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I have Strictly Ballroom at 11. Hilarious. Oh, Baz Luhrmann.
Great movie, yeah.
Yeah, really fun. I have Newsies at 12. I know this movie has its flaws, but I love the songs and it's very nostalgic for me.
Great.
And then at 13, I have Leap of Faith, which is a really interesting movie about this charlatan preacher guy played by Steve Martin. Mm. And one of my favorite episodes of Hallmarkies podcast, we had Gordon Holmes on. Mm. We talked about Leap of Faith, and I really enjoyed that episode. So it's kind of nostalgic for me as well on that level.
All right.
So, that's some of my honorable mentions.
And I will mention, you know, other than the movies that were on your list that I like all of them. So those would probably all be on my runner-up honorable mention list. But also feel like it was a pretty fun year for horror movies in 1992. You have Candyman, but also horror comedies like Brain Dead and Army of Darkness, which I really enjoy. There's also, for Hong Kong, you also have Police Story 3 with Jackie Chan and Michelle Yeoh. A pretty fun movie for the most part, that it's kind of okay, but becomes absolutely incredible in its last kind of like climactic act, in which there's some of the most incredible stunts I've ever seen. Michelle Yeoh jumps like a motorcycle onto a moving truck or moving train. I can't remember which one it is. Something that could have easily killed her, but I don't know how she did it and pulled it off. And it's just incredible to watch. So that's a lot of fun for those people who like action movies. The movie Boomerang with Eddie Murphy, it's a very interesting rom-com, very fun. I don't know if you've seen that one, Rachel, but it'd be interesting to know what you think about that.
Yeah, I've heard about that. I need to see it.
Yeah, that's fun. Basic Instinct is also a very fun movie that I enjoy a lot, with Sharon Stone, Paul Verhoeven movie. And this is not a movie I love, but I think it's a movie that you might be really into, Rachel, because it is a period piece and a literary adaptation, and it's romantic, which is like Water for Chocolate. Have you ever seen that movie?
I haven't.
So I think you would really enjoy that. And also, I think you would really enjoy the book since you're a big reader. But I know that my mom and my family really loved that movie when I was younger, and the book as well.
Very cool. Well, let us know if you're listening what you think, what your top five would be from 1992. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yes, definitely. And this will be the end of Criterion Project Season 3. But yep. Don't worry, we'll be right back on schedule with Season 4. We're not taking a break. So we'll see you or you'll be listening to us very soon.
Yes. Yeah. And if you are listening on iTunes, please leave your ratings and reviews. That helps us so much. We really appreciate it. And make sure you're following us at Criterion Pod on Twitter. We have a lot of fun on there. And Conrado, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at CocoHitsNY. And if you want to see my web series on YouTube, it's called Wormholes. And you need to search Wormholes, the series on YouTube, and you can find it.
Great. And you can find me at Rachel's Reviews, all of our social media, iTunes, YouTube, and on Rotten Tomatoes. So check that out. Also, make sure that you check out the Hallmarkies podcast. We have a lot of fun over there.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Bye.